us trampling on the stones. It's us down, down to the bone. Blood is thick, waters were known well, cousins were kept apart, mothers were often memories. Fathers were not favorites on the farm, for he could do some harm, he could wreck the master scheme, for he, brothers, could dream. Your mama ain't no saint, your daddy died in a shallow stream, but your uncle Dr. King did have a dream, my brother. And what is your real excuse? Why can't you study your lessons and stay in school? Why can't you study your lessons and stay in school? Free love and sex ain't nothing but a game. Don't never last, try hope. Take a chance on love. Register to vote. Money ain't everything, but you could buy a ring.
By Sunchi Ali.
Buy you a record of a Yardbird with me.
Welcome to the Coomeram Report. May the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. My name is Melvin Ishmael Johnson, coming at you live from Skid Row Studios. And I'm in the studio with my co-host, Earlene Anthony. Our call-in number is 1-800-893-9562. Now, this week on the Coomeram Report, we have in the studio our guest host, Al-Hajj Muhammad Abdullah, with a special guest, and he's going to discuss Islam and Muslims in the world. Welcome to the Coomeram Report. Now, before we get into our discussion, I have on the line my brother, Rashad Wali Muhammad, calling from Boston, California. Rashad, salam alaikum.
Walaikum salam, wa rahmatullah, wa barakatuh.
Alhamdulillah, how things going?
Alhamdulillah, all right. Everything is going all right.
Yeah,
you know, hey, by the will of Allah.
Alhamdulillah. Hey, do they have an Islamic community up there in Boxville? How is it up there?
Well, there's no Islamic community in Boxville at the moment and everything, you know, for as I can see. Mm-hmm. You know, I haven't ran into very few Muslims up here, you know. I haven't ran into any, really.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, they don't have a mass here. Or anything like that?
No, nothing like that. No, it's a smaller city.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some cities don't have a smaller community or no community, and some cities are big that have too many masjids in one city.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know how it is in Boxer out there in the desert, because when I was in the Marines, I was stationed pretty close out there. I know it got to be hot out there now. Yeah.
Yeah, y'all, yeah. Well, today, the last couple of days, we've been having some rain up here, you know, and so it's been kind of cooled down. The wind blows a lot up this way, you know.
Yeah.
So it seemed like it's a little quiet town and everything, you know.
Yeah, and yeah. I was talking to down home today in Greenville, Mississippi. Mom's told me it was over like 105, something like that down there. Yeah, she said
105.
Yeah, 115.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's burning up in the desert, but I mean in the Delta, but it's a little cool. So what do you want to say to Greenville and the family down there in the Delta? Hmm?
Well, I want to tell Greenville that I always be a Mississippian, you know. I want to, and I have to tell my family, you know, I will always love them physically and spiritually.
Yes.
And that I'm blessed and thankful to be able to come through the family that I came through.
I'm
you know, and all the teaching, and all the teaching and everything that I got from my mother and father, you
yes.
know, that I carry with me today.
Yes.
You know, so I
and because you
might be in different faiths.
You're mm-hmm. you're a military veteran too. You was in the Air Force.
Oh yes, I stayed in the Air Force for 4 years.
Yeah,
so I was old.
Yeah, when I tell people that out of our family with seven males and two females, that six served in the military, they are surprised. You know, the three of us was in the Army. You and Fred was in the Air Force, and I was in the Marines.
Oh, yeah, that's for real, you know. That was that one of those times, you know, we didn't know a lot of stuff what we know now.
Yes.
You know, so at the moment, you know, we was just trying to be the best Americans that we could be.
Yeah.
You know, still try to be that since we in America. You have to obey the laws of America since we here.
Yes.
Like some some Muslims, you know, when they migrate here and everything, you know, they bring along their ethnic with them, you know.
Yes.
So that's why a lot of masjids be full of ethnics and not just Muslims. You know, you got Arab leagues and all the other kind of disunity.
Yeah.
When you're supposed to be just Muslim.
Yeah.
Don't carry a title or be part of a set.
Yeah, we're gonna talk a little about that today. All right, then. Look, hey, how's Halima?
I'm doing all right. She's doing fine. That's the will of Allah.
Beautiful, because I know you're just finishing up Ramadan and all of that. All right, then. So good to holler at you. Looking forward to you come through Los Angeles. Looking forward to it.
By the will of Allah, I'll be there soon.
Alhamdulillah. Salaam alaikum.
All right. Wa alaikum salaam.
Yes. Okay, thank you, Rashad Wali Muhammad, my brother, out there in Boxer, California. Now, at this time, I'd like to turn it over to our guest host, Al-Hajj Muhammad Abdullah, and he will make the introduction.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As-salamu alaykum.
Wa alaykum as-salam.
Eid Mubarak, Eid Kareem. By the grace and mercy of Allah, with the honored guest, Imam Ishaq Abdul Hafiz, inshallah, and the topic being Islam and Muslims in the world, I would like to ask the Imam in regards to the Eid and its significance, and then inshallah, for those who don't know about Eid al-Fitr, in regards to the end of Ramadan.
As-salamu alaykum. Alhamdulillah, praises be to Allah, the God, the most merciful, the beneficent, and peace and blessings be upon his prophet Muhammad and all of the prophets. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon them, their families, companions, and those that follow them in righteous intentions. As you just articulated, we as Muslims throughout the world have just completed the fasting for the sacred month of Ramadan. And at the conclusion of that is the Eid, or the celebration called Eid al-Fitr. And this is the celebration that the month has completed, and Muslims celebrate collectively throughout the world, thanking Allah that we were able to be so blessed. During the month of Ramadan is the most blessed month. For 29 to 30 consecutive days, the Muslims not only abstain from eating and drinking of liquids and foods and other relationships in the day hours, but also from seeking forgiveness, not only from God, but forgiveness of each other, forgiveness of those who have possibly wronged them. It is a month full of blessings, and for whatever act that one does that is good, then the Prophet, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him, has said a Muslim will receive to 10 rewards for every act of goodness that one does. And so it's a month full of persons looking out and seeking to increase, you know, their blessings and increase the brotherhood. And one of the outcomes that we look forward to in Ramadan is that once we go through this period of time where we really can relate to the poor, to the homeless, to the needy, that, you know, we who can be able to find food at the end of this month don't want to forget those who at the end of it continually don't have things to eat, who don't have their basic needs. And so it tries to inculcate on a global level Muslims to have compassion and care and empathy for the poor, and to continually to do something for them, and to have an outcome. Like I said, when Ramadan is over, we want to be invigorated and mobilized to get actively involved in the community and to be out in caring and for others. And so hopefully that is one of the things that we will see here locally as well as globally, the Muslim to get out and put their hands together with those who are going through struggles and difficulties.
Oh, praise be to Allah. By the grace and mercy of Allah, in regards to the emphasis that's being placed on a lot of violence that's going on here and abroad, I want to touch on first the recent election of Nigeria's president, Muhammadu Buhari is the president of Nigeria, and he just came to meet with President Barack Obama. And one of the key topics they spoke about is Boko Haram and the transgressions that have been going on. And from the criterion of Islam, we see that this behavior of kidnapping women, girls, and killing people, et cetera. Would you elaborate on how is it that people continue to say that these are Muslims when this is contrary to the criterion of Islam?
You know, that is the propaganda of those that want to try to disparage the faith of Islam by knowingly acknowledging that anyone that commits acts so heinous and so inhumane, you know, in these acts that this it's occurring in Nigeria as well as other places, any brutality that includes civilians and women and children and the elderly, destruction of land. These are things that are so averse to Islam, and that is absolutely clear. For this, Islam is a religion, not only a religion of peace, but it's a religion that people believe in God, and godliness is something that is clearly from that which is wicked and evil. And so to associate in any way these types of behaviors is only that can be perpetrated, you know, by those who want to cast Islam in this disparaging way by identifying these persons as Muslim extremists. And these people have no connection to Islam whatsoever. These are just brutal persons who, you know, in their own mind, they want to take over and control through fear and brutality. Because it's the only good that comes out of what they're doing is to brutalize and to put fear in other villagers and other persons in smaller communities so that they can intimidate and to oppress. And Islam is against oppression. And this is why the challenge is for Muslims to live this faith in a participatory kind of a way that makes it absolutely clear. And this is one of the beautiful things about Muslims in America, through the different charitable organizations and the different agencies and entities that go to all over the world trying to make sure that they can feed the poor and do for others. Even down south where the black churches have been set ablaze, Muslims have raised over $100,000 to help to rebuild, you know. But this is not in the news. This is not spoken of. But if a person who has any inkling connection with Islam through a name, his name is Arabic or something, and he does something horrific or horrendous, then this is all publicized about, you know, Islamically is being done. Whereas when these same kind of acts are done by others, whatever the religion is not ever associated or affiliated with this kind of madness and things. But again, it just puts the challenge upon us even more to clearly articulate what is Islam and what is not Islam. Again, you cannot be a God-fearing person, and one who is aspiring and aspirations is to be rewarded by God going to heaven to do these types of acts that are clearly the work of devil, you know, and that are evil. And Muslims believe in, I mean, good is real and bad is real. Evil is real. And, you know, to counter that, we must establish, you know, through our interaction with each other and our relationships with each other to really accentuate the best, you know, in mankind. And this is what the Quran continually calls us to be the best, you know.
And I also, in regards to what's taking place in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Now here, Marines have been murdered. And by reportedly a fellow Marine, and his name, Muhammad Yusuf Abdulaziz. And what amazes me is that how is that immediately people's names can become up, and then this history, and then to kill combat soldiers, and simultaneously equate that with terrorism, etc. And then, as you alluded to earlier, like in regards to the Christians and Columbia, South Carolina, where 9 people were killed in a place of worship, in church, and multiple people wounded. And the director of the FBI was questioned in the press conference, said, this is not terrorism. How do you address that when you're disseminating information to the people to show how Muslims are characterized immediately in a negative manner when others are doing things and they don't say, okay, these are adherents to Judaism, these are adherents to Christianity, Buddhism, etc.
Yeah, these are the things that we are, you know, confronted with. Just as when these acts happen, you know, the whole Muslim community is for some reason, is ostracized, or we have to sometimes place in a position as if we have to apologize for acts that individuals do. And this is nothing new for us as African-Americans, because we historically have always had to apologize for something that was allegedly done by one of the persons in our community. You know, going back to even to slavery, if someone was raped or if something happened to somebody, they could grab any African-American and burn them or lynch them. The whole community had to, you know, take on this guilt. Somebody, you know, like I said, from those periods of time to this day, an act can occur, and our whole community has to have this communal guilt. And that same now thing is applying to Muslims. You know, this young person, it appears from his family that he had mental problems. He told me alcohol problem, drug problems. I mean, there's many things that was possibly behind this particular behavior. As we're seeing these kind of shootings happening across this country. And when the other persons are, you know, whatever their faith or their family's faith is, that's never brought into the picture. But when it comes to a person from an Islamic family, had any inklings or any connections with Islam, then these kind of things are attributed, you know, to the faith or attributed to the community. And this is totally, you know, unfair. You know, we as a people who live in this society and even not only living in this society, we're for good in all societies. I mean, we don't want to see any brutality perpetrated on anyone, you know, as Muslims. That's how we carry this in reality. And we feel for the families of the soldiers. We feel for the families of the law enforcement. We feel the families of the innocent victims that are killed by law enforcement. I mean, so our, you know, perspective and our role is to stop the madness and to try to be create reconciled circumstances and situations. One of the most beautiful things that we try to do as Muslims is to establish mechanisms for there to be reconciliation, just like what we saw to happen in Liberia and in Sierra Leone after they had these conflicts, what we saw happen in South Africa. These are the kind of things that are going to be needed, you know, and continue to be needed, you know, even here with our struggles that we see with our young people in these cities that have these conflicts and these killing and these murders, is that more and more we have to teach them about forgiveness and about how to sit down and to be able to come to a common ground and a common nality that we as human beings cannot kill each other off. That we have to live in this world together, inshallah.
Okay, excuse me. By the grace of mercy, well, one of the key things, too, I've been really evaluating it on, and that is the conscious behavior that Saudi Arabia is doing in Yemen. And at the various masajid, I never hear in the khutbah nobody talk about Saudi Arabia's transgression against the fellow Muslim brethren in Yemen. How is it that they can be and feel justified in doing what they're doing, and they are regarded as the custodians over Mecca and Medina?
You know, these are the, you know, contradictory realities and the hypocrisy that we see oftentimes through because of politics. People are afraid to speak out. Again, we go back to what Islam is about, and we're, you know, as individuals as well as collectively, enjoining the right and forbidding the wrong. Even if that's against ourself, even if that's against, you know, our family, that's against our nation, if wrong is done, we should be able to speak out against that wrong. And what we aren't seeing is the, you know, Muslim community and Muslim leadership, or persons who consider themselves leaders, not speaking out against this wrong. You absolutely are correct. What the Saudis are doing is not being the bridge and finding reconciliation with the Yemenis that are having this conflict with each other. They jumped in it, and now they're perpetuating, you know, some brutal things that are happening to citizens, to innocent civilians. And this is being reported by all of the media. I mean, it's no secret that many, many innocent persons, women and children and elderly persons, are being killed and murdered in these different, you know, conflicts. And it's all, you know, generated and based on nothing but somebody trying to uphold an individual who's a friend of theirs, you know, not about right and wrong, not about finding what is the base cause of the disturbance among the Yemeni people that can bring about, you know, reconciliation. That's one of the beautiful things that I was reading recently that's happening in Afghanistan, is that Sheikh Umar, the former, the leader of the Taliban, is now sitting down and talking with the current Afghan government, because they know that there has to be reconciliation. Like I said, conflicts cannot go on forever and ever. You know, when people come of good mind and righteous mind, and they really act upon their faith, they're going to look for ways, not that I'm going to beat you down, but how can we sit at the table and share in the responsibility of our society and our country and our people? And it's just sad that, and this is why, you know, as Muslims, we don't follow people just because they are, you know, from the Middle East or just because they're, you know, from Saudi Arabia and they're supposed to be the custodians of the two holy sacred sites, that just in and of that makes them and whatever they do good and right. No, and the beauty of being in America, we can speak out against that. You know, we can challenge that and not feel that, you know, we can be, you know, discriminated against or be attacked for that. You know, and if so, then let that be. But we at least have the opportunity to voice, you know, this truth. And, you know, one of the sayings of the prophet is that one of the signs of faith is that if you see a wrong and you have the ability and the mechanism to remove it with your hand, then you remove it. If you don't have the ability to remove it with your hand, then you speak out against it. If you don't have the ability to speak out against it, then hate it in your heart. And the weakest of faith, but still faith, is to hate it in your heart. But when you have the ability to speak out against wrongs and injustices, in particular when it comes from high places, when it comes from powerful and mighty people, then you want to be able to do that. And this is one of the beautiful things about this program and about, you know, I know your work over the years is that when there's wrong and then there's injustices, you know, you speak out against that and you challenge that. And this is what we must continue to do, and this is what we must inculcate in our youth, is to speak out against wrong and to speak out against that which is not correct and to try to stand up on the principles of righteousness and goodness. Because when we see societies not doing this, then how can we ask for the young kids on the streets not to be gangbanging? You know, if the government in the country can have flybys, then how you going to tell somebody not to have a drive-by? You know, when they see that you aren't sitting down and talking things out, then it trickles down. Like they always say, the best, you know, people don't do what they hear, they do what they see you do. And so to be the best example is that we must lead by example.
Also, also in regards to the nations and with the leadership that President Obama has initiated in regards to the Islamic Republic of Iran and the nuclear deal that was just made, and also the reassurance of the apartheid state of Israel and Saudi Arabia in their fear of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And now, how is it that, as it says in politics, they are strong, you know, has strange bedfellows? Here's the apartheid state of Israel and Saudi Arabia in collusion with one another against the Islamic Republic of Iran and always using the premise that one is Sunni and Shia, et cetera. How do you address that in regards to people knowing what is, as you pointed out, in regards to even with the apartheid state of Israel, with Dr. Benudu, he points out that Israel has nuclear weapons, but nobody talks about their nuclear weapons.
Exactly. And this is the thing that's unfair, you know, especially when it comes to nations. You know, every nation has its right to be able to defend itself and to, you know, have its own self-determination. No nation, no matter how large or mighty it is, has the should have the authority to tell a smaller nation that you can't do what I do, you know. And this is sometimes what comes out. One of the things I must, you know, commend our President Obama about, though, is that even when in his first term, he, you know, spoke that he wanted to have engagement with the Islamic Republic of Iran. He wanted to have engagement with Cuba. He wanted to have engagement with these nations that have been on the surface enemies. And, you know, and I thought that was a bold move. It's taken him 8 years, but for him to continue to fulfill that obligation. And again, what else, as he said, what is the alternative? You can't keep having fights and wars with everybody. It has to come a time where you have to find common ground, even with those that are your enemy, that have, where there's commonality, let's be civil. And we see that same situation when it comes to the with Russia, the USSR. The U.S. has a relationship with Russia. They have a relationship with China. They have a relationship with many others that are considered their enemy on certain levels. So why not with Cuba? Why not with the Islamic Republic of Iran, who was one of the best friends of the United States before 1979? The Iranian people didn't change. They didn't change their religion. They were Muslims when the Shah was alive, and it was the number one partner with the United States on so many levels. But when they became more independent and said, we didn't want you to house, you know, your spying entities and things from our country onto Russia, because Russia's our neighbor, we didn't want to be on the front line of your stuff, then all of a sudden, you know, you became the pariah of the world. And, you know, this whole thing on that they support terrorism, and it's, you know, who's calling, you know, who can throw stones when it comes to any of these nations on the politics and the war machinery that they all are involved in. It's like they should just stop it. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, really, I mean, that they treat the citizenry of the world as if we all are ignorant. All of them are involved in doing something that's, you know, supporting some cause that somebody else can call that group of terrorists outside of your own group and things, you know. So to just try to use that as an excuse to hold Iran back, you know, is ludicrous. And again, what is the alternative, you know? And hopefully we will see this further acting upon it. Even Israel, you know, talking tough on one hand, and they too know the reality. I heard a report yesterday that the military and the secret services of Israel know this is the best deal that's on the table. And they got to play this political thing with the citizenry and acting like, oh, they really against it and this and that. And they know, you know, you take this or what's the alternative, you know? And again, for the world, we cannot continue to see this bloodletting. I mean, it breaks my heart to see the conflict between the Palestinians and the Israelis. 60 years of bloodletting. And these are people that consider themselves, you know, and it's not, you know, they all consider themselves religious. But where is the religion? And where in the rest of the world, the Christian majority of the world, where are they in stopping this kind of madness? You know, the land is not even that large for them to be in this kind of a conflict for this kind of period of time. So again, you know, good people must continually challenge these persons behind the scenes who are profiting, because there's a lot of profit being made in order, you know, to castigate one against the other, you know. When just as you mentioned, like with the Saudis, I mean, all of the weaponry that they're buying, all of the hardware, war machinery that they're buying for all of these last 20 to 30 years being manipulated, you know? And it's just, if that could be used more for the development of their society, you know, and for the rest of that part of the world, everybody could be living almost on a middle-class level in that part of the world, and more things they could be able to do for other places in Africa and other third world countries with the funds that they're buying more jets and more bombs and more missiles just because they use those on the surface, that Iran is a threat. Stop it. Stop it.
I was reflecting also in regards to Islamic education, and I always think about when Malcolm X, when he made Hajj, and then he brought back scholarships and for brothers to go to study. Now, how do you see, and also, and how did you benefit, and how is it that it can be institutionalized to develop Islamic learning in the educational institutions here in America, specifically high schools and community colleges and universities?
You know, one of the wonderful things that with this electronical ability now and smart equipment, learning, you don't have to go overseas as we once had to do. As you mentioned, when Malcolm went overseas, he opened up some avenues, particularly for African Americans, that we never had had before, to have scholarships going to study in Egypt, to go study in the Sudan, as well as in Saudi Arabia. And I know many Americans who have gone to study in Yemen and went to study in Syria. So there's all of the major universities where Islamic knowledge was. Today, one doesn't have to do that, because the learning can be done online, on Skype, even, you know, with a live professor or a live teacher, Quran studies and things, beginning even at elementary levels. I know that there are Quranic classes being done right now with little children over the internet with a live teacher, and many of them are learning, you know, to memorize the whole Quran through this mechanism. Zaytun University in Northern California is one of the first Islamic universities here in America and in the West that has been accredited recently. So now we're having not only just universities, but accredited universities. And there's an increase of institutes teaching and making available Islamic knowledge without those having to leave, you know, here to go to the historical sites, even though it's a wonderful thing to go to historical sites, just to see, you know, the historical places where the battles took place, or where, you know, the prophets actually walked, and where they, you know, journeyed and things, is a wonderful addition. But the actual learning process now is available here and is being generated towards our youth. And there are many young American young people born here, children of Muslims, who are getting this education, getting this knowledge. And I think we're going to really see a difference. You know, just as we, one of the things, you know, last time when I was here and we spoke about my becoming a Muslim, and when I was in college, one of the things I didn't get to touch upon was when I came into the knowledge that not only that Africa, you know, 70% was Muslim, but that from the Songhai dynasty and from when Mansa Musa made pilgrimage, 10 years after he made pilgrimage, the gifts that he gave away had devastated the economy going across the whole desert. And when you had the universities of Timbuktu, and you had the universities in Morocco, and the universities in Tunis, and the universities in Cairo, learning that because the story had been, the reason we were enslaved was because, you know, we were heathens, and that they were trying to humanize us because we were savages. Then when you find out that Islam had universities, and they were had magnificent cities and the businesses that was all through West Africa, and the power and the universities that was there that got destroyed when slavery came in, and that they knew about Christianity. So then it's like they lied. I mean, those are the things, I mean, that really pole vaulted me when I realized the wealth of how Islam, the Muslims had ruled Spain for more than 850 years. And so when you saw, you know, these things that we never heard before, and you saw that they didn't do this through the might of the gun or of swords, and but through economics, through opportunity, through the Muslims marrying the persons in which they lived with them. You know, whereas like with the slavery that was here, the Europeans didn't marry the slaves. You know, and even if the slaves became Christian, that didn't lead to freedom. That didn't lead to their, you know, independence. They still was being castigated if they learned how to read and write. So you really saw the disparity on what they claimed that they were supposed to be doing by civilizing us if we became Christian. But even after we became Christian, they even devastated us even more in their trying to turn us into being zombies of themselves. Whereas when you looked at the Islamic history and you saw the comparison, it was like, wow, this is truly something that they hid from us. And this is why it's so important that our young people, you know, learn about Islam. Because, again, we need to learn about forgiveness, knowing the connection with forgiveness and prayer. Because things happen that really are hurtful and hard, and, you know, to someone. But until they can be able to forgive, then you can't have reconciliation. And so you can't be able to get beyond this revenge and this retaliation. And once we can be able to do that, so we can change the reality of our communities, and then from a microcosmic kind of a way, and start seeing how this can transfer to around the world. Because we cannot, you know, continue to believe that the human family will continue if we don't find ways not to kill each other. Because if everybody gets a nuclear bomb, and then everybody wants to use it when they get angry, and you know, then they'll just devastate, you know, we'll wipe each other out and won't exist again. So rather everybody gets it and we still learn, okay, you can have it, but let's don't use it. You know, can we not find, but again, it takes people of faith. People without faith are not gonna, you know, use these tools. And again, what we as people of faith are seeing is we're challenged. You know, we're challenged to let things be the status quo, or that we in our lifetime want to be able to know that the prophets of old were able to change the reality of their time. If enough people of faith act with that faith, we too can make a difference, you know, that can take these weapons, you know, and help people to lay them down, you know. Yeah, weapons are necessary, but at the same time, people got to learn how that's not the first thing to pick up when there's an issue with each other. And that's from, like I said, from a microcosmic kind of a way to the macro, from individuals to societies.
I was reading just recently, I'm currently reading one of the books, is Pre-Colonial Black African, Dr. Sheikh Anta Diop. And he spoke about Tariq al-Sudan, Tariq al-Fattah, Ibn Khaldun. And I thought about when Dr. Carter G. Woodson, and his book, The Miseducation of the Negro, mentioning Tariq Al-Sadat and Tariq Al-Fattah here. And this was in the 30s, and it wasn't even translated then. And for them to be speaking, especially Dr. Carter G. Woodson, in the 30s, talking about the education and the scholarship of Islamic Africa. Could you elaborate, like, on the history of that Tariq al-Sadat, Tariq al-Fattah, and Ibn Khaldun in regards to the Western world and how they benefit from that source?
I would like for you to delve into that.
Allahu Akbar. Yeah, because by the grace and mercy of Allah, is that I had met a Muslim brother, and we were at the Masjid Umar Ibn al-Khattab hadn't been built. On exposition in Vermont, we were praying in just in the house and in the complex. And so I asked him, I said, well, what is your major? He said, sociology. I said, wow. I said, you know who the father of sociology is? He said, no. I said, Ibn Khaldun. He said, who is he? And he was graduating that month, the next month from USC. He had never heard of Ibn Khaldun.
Wow.
And then I said, well, I said, you ever heard of the Muqaddima? He said, I don't know what it is. I said, okay. And by the grace of mercy, well, I was Sheikh Jamaluddin, who was a scholar and self-taught by the grace of mercy of Allah and a linguist. And he would say that the Muqaddima was just the introduction. And to see that Dr. Carter G. Woodson spoke about that, and he said in order to talk about history and Africa's history, we must know about this great history. And Sheikh Muhammad Sharif and Dr. John Humwick, they have now translated the Tariq al-Sudan. And to let us know, again, that history, that rich history of West Africa. And also with Sylvian Diop, as I pointed out, in regards to servants of Allah. I wanted to ask you too, Imam, like, in regards to, like, the online courses, is there a online course or courses for people that are incarcerated?
You know, this is wonderful that you asked this question, because there, Bilal Phillips has an online university. It's been for like 4 or 5 years. That was on it for free. They've now just made it because, you know, the inmates don't have access to the computers. So what they've done is now they put everything on DVD and CDs and in book form. And then through the chaplains, you know, allowing the guys to have access to the DVD players, they are now sending the materials there. And so they have a 8-point courses, a diploma course. And for the guys that get through the diploma course that want to get their undergraduate degree, they can get the undergraduate degree all the way to the master's degree. This is something that's just going on as we speak. There's another organization called Taiba Foundation that is a study course. And the brothers Old Folsom, there's about 30 brothers taking the course right now. This, too, is a class that specifically is for the brothers inside. And they have put on lectures that were taped for regular classroom, university classes, and then sent to the brothers. I mean, and I've seen the material and seen the brothers learn, you know, Quran, learn tafsir, learn the basics, you know, hadith studies. It's really, really wonderful. This has been going on about 3 or 4 years. A number of the federal facilities, but California State in particular, because the brother was from California, from Northern California, who started the Taiba Foundation. And so that it's at a number of the state facilities. The brothers are taking those classes. And then there's one that's just starting now, Sheikh Umar from the IIOC, the Islamic Institute of Orange County. Is now making his materials, because they also have an online course. But through their Prison Dawah Outreach Program from Umar Khattab Masjid in Anaheim, they now are, and in fact, they partnered with Taiba Foundation so that they can be able to now make coursework available for correspondence courses for the brothers and sisters inside. Not just limited to the brothers, but also for the sisters to be able to learn. And this is, like I said, as we speak, some of the most exciting things that we've always been waiting for. Brothers have always been asking for some kind of correspondence courses. And these are quality courses, similar, and much of it is following the path of materials that was studied in Medina, and at Mecca University and things is the coursework that the brothers are learning. So they have good, solid, foundational basis in their faith, alhamdulillah.
Allahu Akbar.
I wanted to ask you also, like, in regards to, like, for us, we had spoke previously, too, about, like, housing for people when they're getting released, and also, like, women and children, what type of resources are being, put together for people that are being released and to reunite with their families?
Right now, we have a transition home in Pomona that we have just begun to receive brothers coming home. There's two structures, and one is going to be for sisters because they have their separate entrances and they're two separate, but they're on the same, you know, street. And we are, you know, right now developing some programs for them. We want to have the Islamic 12-step program, Malati to Islam, that we want to be able to institute. I was just speaking with some brothers today that's going to come in and help to get that going, to be facilitators until we can, you know, train the brothers and sisters inside how to be facilitators. We do hope it, at some point this will be our pilot program. Once we can really hone this in and get the good structure, we're going to start a peer program for brothers coming out. I've been just informed that there's a number of brothers who, even who have been out a long time, have said they never had a situation to talk about the experience and how wounded they still feel that they are, and how this will help even the brothers who are just coming out. But it's going to be such an inclusive kind of a program. And these are things that we're working on right now. And we do hope, as you mentioned, Brother Muhammad, that sometimes there are sisters with families that we do want to be able to incorporate, you know, shelter for them as well, inshallah.
Alhamdulillah. So by the grace of mercy of Allah, I want to thank you, Brother Imam Ishaq, and alhamdulillah, inshallah. And now I'll turn it over to Brother Ishmael.
Okay, assalamu alaikum. Great information. We're going to come back to the round table in a minute. Let's go over to our community calendar, and then we'll come back and open it up to our round table.
This is the community calendar of upcoming events. This Thursday, July the 23rd, 2015, at 7:30 p.m. Drama Stage Qumran, L.A. Labor Fest, and Public Work Improvisational Theater present a reading of If the Shoe Fits, Voices from Solitary Confinement. After the reading, there will be a time for Q&A, sharing stories, discussing strategies and ways to take action. Also, writing letters and sign up for legislative visits. This is a statewide coordinated action to end solitary confinement, and performances will be held on the 23rd of the month throughout the year end at different locations. This event on the July 23rd, 2015, the location is the Westside Peace Center, 3916 Sepulveda Boulevard in Culver City, California, 90230. It's a free event, free parking, and all are invited to attend. For more information, you can email lalaborfest@gmail.com or call 310-704-3217. And please save this date, Saturday, August 30th, 2015, from 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. Industrial Green will be holding its first annual summer fundraiser. The location is Lot 613 on Imperial. This is a family-friendly event. There will be food, drinks, music, and display of current and future projects, and much, much more. For information, you can contact industrialdistrictgreen.org. And this is a Catherine Magnini project. If you have a community event that you would like announced on our show, send the information to dramastage1@yahoo.com. Attention, Earlene Anthony. And the call-in number for our show is 800-893-9562. Now, back to our host.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Earlene Anthony. We're back in the with our in-studio guest. And I want to open up... I want to open up our round table, and what I would like to discuss now is what are the implications for the marriage form of polygamy, in light of the Supreme Court decision to legalize same-sex marriage. Can we talk about that for a while?
I think it definitely puts it on the table in a legitimate format to be looked at. If they can, you know, come out of totally something that's not traditional whatsoever and give it some right and give it life, then for sure there is something that is historical that has been a part of the human experience, which is polygamy, for many, you know, legitimate and purposeful reasons, and you know, and religiously based, and not even just you know, Islamically, but even in the you know, the other forms of Christian faith, it is something that is there. It's not something scripturally that says one. It's something that the society in and of themselves have done. But when you look at the reality of women who don't have you know, a mate, and the and it's not about just we know that people, human beings, need relationships until they don't live anymore. You know, you can be 80, 90 years old, and you still need to have an emotional connected relationship. And polygamy offers this for a lot of times a person is a widower, and she still has desires, you know, humanistically to be with another human, you know, another person. And this has always been something that was able to be facilitated. Again, it's not always about marrying somebody just because they can have children. You know, you can have a wife that's, you know, beyond childbearing years, and at the same time have one that's, you know, younger. And in most societies, that's not really the issue, and it's not about, you know, this being my property, you know, the woman being the man's property or the man being the woman's property. Usually where there was issues about polygamy is where this is selfishness. But when one looks at, I wouldn't want, you know, my sister to not be able to have a legitimate relationship, because a person can have a relationship and people do it all the time, but it's illegitimate when it's outside of a wedlock, you know, which is a bond, which is a commitment, which is a contract, which is your partners, you know, you're there for each other till death, not just, you know, a fling and things. I mean, so what polygamy offers to keep a society, you know, not only sane, but pure and wholesome, is something that's not available except under the table. Mm. Whereas by them opening up something, like I said, totally that's outside of the norm historically among human beings, now they should look at something that is a part of the norms. And like I said, that is religiously based and supported. And again, it's not something just because a person wants to do it. They're Islamically, there's some criteria by which one must meet in order to, you know, have more than one wife, you know, and there's a limit for one, you know, there can't be more than four, but the person has to be able to sustain them and to take care of them and those kinds of things. So it's not like, you know, somebody can just go out and just exploit this whole situation. And that's why it would be good if it was in a you know, a legalistic kind of a way through the society. But I think that it definitely is something that should be brought to the table, you know, as we move forward in the future. And when we, like I said, when we look at the disparity of, of women and men, and women living longer than men, again, it is tragic when, you know, a woman loses her husband at 40-something years old, or she's 50-something years old, and she may live another 30, 40 years, and the only relationship she can have is an illegitimate relationship with somebody or somebody else's husband that she can maybe be around with, and, you know, all these kind of other things that happen, rather than she can have another mate that is totally legitimate on every level for her mentally, socially, and all of those kinds of, you know, mechanisms, which is very important. You know, that is a social accommodation and something that is done around the world. I mean, it's not like it's not practiced around the world. It is practiced around the world to this day. And we know in those societies, we don't see the same kind of diseases that we see in the Western part of the world, as well as all of the other disparities, you know, family-wise, that we see in the Western part of the world that we don't see in the parts of the world where it is practiced and things, you know. So it's again, it's not something that's foreign from a world scale. It's just something in the West that they haven't entertained. But since they've entertained this other whole situation, you know, and they've even expanded that to something totally different. You know, now that they, you know, the transgender, I mean, that's a whole separate.
So to get it to the Supreme Court, a case would have to be first initiated on the local level and then the federal level, and then to push it up to the Supreme Court.
Right.
Okay. Do you want to say anything, Aki, on it?
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. It reminded me of a former president of Delta Sigma Theta, and she had admonished the women of Delta Sigma Theta and saying that some of us are already practicing polygamy. and within the next convention, they got rid of her.
Okay.
But, you know, just touching on that, you know, there are some states where it is, you know, even California has been known for having, you know, some persons, you know, practicing this in this state, in Utah, and Utah. Colorado, and you know, even though they on the books, it doesn't support, but they know it's happening, and they, you know, in Texas, you know, in these little isolated, so these states are so big, probably Alaska, they just leave them alone, but it is being practiced here, you know, but it's just not on a large scale. And I've known persons, you know, around the country who have practiced it for more than 40 years, and they've never had any issues and haven't gone to courts or nothing else and got, you know, healthy families and 20, 30 kids.
Yeah, and I think this is definitely the right time to look at that situation. So let's go around for some closing comments and contact information.
All right, by the grace and mercy of Allah, there's going to be a program for one of our beloved brothers who returned to Allah, Abdul Latif, formerly Charles Jones. He was my childhood and adult best friend. And may Allah bless him with the paradise. It's going to be next Sunday, or Sunday coming up at the Fever Center on Slauson and Crenshaw from 3:30 to 9. And everyone is welcome by the grace and mercy of Allah. He was an activist, and he was a former member of the Black Panther Party and the Nation of Islam, and Ahli Sunnah Wa Jamaat, and the follower in the Jamaat of the Sheikh Uthman Don Fodi or Rahim Allah. My email address is two. One is SHEIKHMO99@gmail.com. SHEIKHMO1999@yahoo.com. My address is Taif Tul Islam, TAIF hyphen TUL hyphen Islam, ISLAM, PO Box 338. Compton, California, 90220.
And I would just like to thank you all so much for having me here. And I hope in the future to bring information. We're trying to recruit more Muslims to be volunteers in the jails and the prisons, as well as now at the detention centers. There's a lot of Muslims in detention centers, and nobody's visiting them and seeing them. And they're there just because of immigration issues. You know, they haven't committed any act other than they just don't have documentation. And sometimes they can be lingering in the situations for 8, 9, 10 months or longer. And many of them have never lived here. They've come across the border and got caught at the border. And some of them have horrific stories. And so like to share that in the future of how, you know, a person can get involved in that. We'll get my email is AAB, like in baby U, DIYA73@AOL.com. That's Albudia73@AOL.com.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, we're winding down. I'd like to mention that the guest host would be back in the studio the last Monday, which is August the 31st, for their monthly show. Looking forward to it. And also a little section that we started. It's called the Lazarus Book Club, which is like Lazarus, I guess, to wake up the dead. We try to recommend a book. And the book that I want to recommend this time is called The Two Babylons by Alexander Hislop, which deals with the origins of a lot of these idol worshiping concepts and holidays. A very good book, The Two Babylons by Alexander Hislop. And I would like to extend a special thanks to our guest host, a special guest in the studio. So please listen to past shows of the Qumran Report by Googling in Qumran Report. Thank you for tuning in to the Qumran Report. from your host, Melvin Ishmael Johnson, from my co-host, Earlene Anthony. May the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. I leave you with the song that opened the show, Homeboy by Sunchi Ali.
Homeboy.
There's only one blood, cause it ain't no sense in us trampling on the stones. It's us, down, down to the bone. Blood is thick, waters were known well, cousins were kept apart, mothers were often memories. Fathers were not favored from the farm, for he could do some harm, he could wreck the master scheme, for he, brothers, could dream.